This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. This past Saturday, January 16th, was a big day in world news, and we at the Trumpet tend to focus on this date because it is the anniversary of the death of the founder of the Plain Truth magazine, Herbert W. Armstrong. This man had a huge impact on the work that we do, really set the blueprint for what we do here at the Trumpet. And on today's program, we're going to talk about three stories that happened on January 16th this year. First of all, this past Saturday saw the launch of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank in Beijing, China. This is a very significant event. It represents China's effort to undermine America's dominance of the global economic system, and it's going to have several significant effects, especially for Europe and throughout Asia and the Eastern Hemisphere. So we're going to talk about some of those effects. Second, January 16th, also you had an election in Taiwan. The Taiwanese people awarded a landslide victory to Tsai Ing-wen of the Democratic Progressive Party, and she has been an outspoken advocate of Taiwanese independence from China. We're going to talk about how China may respond to this election and how this situation may play out in the months ahead. And third, January 16th was the day that the nuclear deal with Iran went into effect, that economic sanctions were lifted on this terrorist-sponsoring state. We're going to talk about the indications that we've already seen of how Iran is likely to use this money and what this is going to mean for the Middle East. We're going to conclude the program today with a change of pace and just give a few words about how to praise your children the right way. The wrong kind of praise actually discourages them, and we're going to talk about how to motivate them through praise. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Global development finance as we know it may soon change. America has really been at the center of the international financial world for many years, but a lot of nations want to change that, and nobody is being more aggressive in trying to do so than China. The launch on Saturday of the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the AIIB, in Beijing represents China's latest, maybe its most forceful effort to undermine America's dominance. I have with me two of our Trumpet writers to discuss this story, our economic writer Robert Morley and our Asia analyst Jeremiah Jacques. Hello, gentlemen.
Great to be with you.
So, Robert, I want you to start, if you will, by just explaining the significance of the creation of this bank. Why does this have the potential to be so have such a huge impact on the world economy?
Yeah, well, I think Larry Summers summed it up pretty well when he talked about this bank a little bit earlier this year. Larry Summers being the former Treasury Secretary of the United States. And when he was talking about it last year, he called it a wake-up call to a new economic era. And according to Summers, this new bank, the launch of this new bank by China, he said it was the most important financial event since the United States took the world off the gold standard back in 1971. So from his perspective and from a lot of other analysts' perspective, looking at what's happening in Asia, they see this as a very significant event in terms of global finance. And when we talk about Bretton Woods, when we talk about the gold standard, these were huge shifts in how the global economy functioned. And people are seeing the same sort of shift today, a shift from a U.S.-centric global financial system to where we're starting to see the first sprouts or the seeds sprouting for a system that competes with America's system.
Explain briefly just kind of the mechanics of what we're talking about here, where the money flows, how China would be at the center of that versus America.
Right. So with this new bank, the Asia Infrastructure and Investment Bank, it was designed to compete with the World Bank, the World Bank being the U.S.-dominated lending institution. And that's one of the primary means by which the United States economically pushes its agenda throughout the world or uses that for leverage to complete its goals, to wield its influence So, other nations.
Just give some examples of, you know, who's taking loans out from the World Bank.
Yeah, absolutely. Any country around the world that most people consider third world or second world nations, these are the nations that are looking for loans and financing. And to do that, they go to the World Bank or they go to the International Monetary Fund, both institutions dominated by the United States. So here we have China now offering them an alternative. You no longer have to go to the Western-centric organizations and, you know, come under some of their restrictions and fall underneath some of their guidelines and do's and don'ts. You can come and play with us and be completely outside of the U.S. system.
Jeremiah, you were talking, as we were discussing this earlier, just about, say, the difference between the way that China would lead in a situation like this and the United States. Maybe you could just talk about that. Say, the difference between American economic leadership and Chinese.
Well, Washington has long used economic leadership as a way to pressure various governments around the world. Sometimes they will even use promises of loans, things like investment, things like that, to punish authoritarian actions. They'll withhold aid or maybe be reluctant to give aid for certain projects if the government is acting in a way with human rights abuses and things like that that Washington does not agree with. And sometimes the U.S. has even used that to try to affect regime change. But China is very different. China has no qualms, no scruples at all with building palaces for despots and just working with tyrants who have egregious human rights abuses. And so they will guarantee territorial integrity, and they'll be more than willing to give loans for various projects despite all kinds of human rights violations or other things that may upset the West and the United Nations.
Robert, this is obviously something that has a lot of potential ramifications. What would you put, say, at the top or near the top of the list in terms of the effects that this will have?
Well, I think one thing we're seeing is the alignment of Europe towards China's financial system in a bigger way than we've ever seen in the past. When this bank was founded, this was something that Washington lobbied its allies very hard against joining this bank. They did not see this as something that was in America's interest or the West's interest. Yet what we saw, beginning with America's closest ally, Great Britain, we saw just a cascade of U.S. allies jumping to be first in line to join this Chinese initiative.
Right. When this first happened, we just talked about what a black eye this was for America, how hard it tried to prevent those nations from joining up and just how unsuccessful it was in doing so. So the real demonstration of just where the alignment is, how things are realigning economically.
I think absolutely. And we are seeing China push very hard on what it calls its Silk Road Initiative. This is its desire to build infrastructure, rail and road and port facilities all along that route from China, that old Marco Polo route from China to Europe. And we have seen Europe, I think, show that it is interested in joining China in that initiative.
So now that this is happening, what does this mean? What does a European Asian or European Chinese link mean?
Yeah, that's a huge geopolitical shift, right? The United States thinks of Europe as its closest allies. But what we are seeing is a fracturing of that. We're seeing Europe and China step out on their own. We're starting to see this creation of a multipolar world, which we have not lived in since the end of World War II. And that's big change when
really,
it comes to America.
Before that, in the Cold War, obviously you had those two nations, but just with that Anglo-American dominance taking place over a period, really a couple hundred years, we're entering a new phase, like Stephen Fleury was bringing out in his program recently, just that post-American world.
Yeah, it is, and I think this is a pretty good sign of that.
So because Europe would be aligning with Asia, what sort of effects might that have economically?
Yeah, well, the world global finance revolves around the dollar, and it has since World War II and since the dollar supplanted the pound. But what we're seeing by China with this initiative, this bank, with its new Chinese international payment system that went operational at the end of October, which allows banks to transfer currencies around the world without going through the dollar intermediaries, we're seeing these little steps being put into place along what we're seeing this trend that China is undergoing as it works towards creating the infrastructure necessary to have a global reserve currency. The United States, global trade revolves and goes through the dollar. And many nations, especially China, don't like that because it lets them come underneath too much pressure from America. America can put too much pressure on them, impact them economically in ways that they don't like. And they want to be outside of America's control. And I think we're seeing, even in Europe, they see, European nations see that they are very dependent on the United States in many ways, in the dollar for trade. And they're looking at pushing agreements like this with China to increase their independence.
We've talked quite a bit about just the effects of the U.S. losing that dollar as global reserve currency status. And this is really a major step in the sort of inevitability of that happening. If you looking at it just the way that you're talking about that there, Jeremiah, what would you say looking at the various effects that this would have? What's another near the top of the list as far as you're concerned?
In my view, the biggest significance of it is the way it falls into the larger context of China's push against what you were discussing earlier, just the push against the U.S.-led world order that has been the status quo in Asia and the whole world, really, for so many decades. We've talked on a previous program about China's push there in the South China Sea, building all the artificial islands in a way that allows it to assert dominance over great swaths of land that are in no wise actually Chinese. But now, suddenly, because America is so weak-willed, China's bold enough to push and to say, you know what, this resource-rich, heavily trafficked area is ours. And I think that we're going to see a lot more pushes like that. And then right alongside that is this bank, which is a direct challenge to American leadership. I'd like to read a quote here from the Washington Times about this, the establishment of the AIIB. It says, "The battle of wills between Beijing and Washington over a China-sponsored development bank for Asia is turning into a rout. The Obama administration has found itself isolated and embarrassed as its top allies lined up this week to join the proposed Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank." So a lot of analysts can see that this is a direct challenge by China against America's dominance. In my view, just placing it alongside other geopolitical events in which we've seen China pushing against that, that is the most significant aspect of this bank.
How much of a tool, Jeremiah, does this give, or a weapon does this give China against other nations in the region that, say, China would want to influence? So, you know, you were talking about maybe how much leverage it would give the United States in dealing with these nations and the way that it would use that leverage to accomplish its ends. What sort of tool does this give China?
Well, imagine if you were Australia and you wanted the AIIB to finance or upgrade a major port. Well, would you want to do anything that upsets the main decision maker behind the AIIB, China? No, you wouldn't. Instead, you would really want to cede a lot of ground to China. You would want to appease it as much as possible.
Right. We're already seeing that happening in Australia, the way that it's conducting its business. We just saw the giving control of the port of Darwin over to China for the next 100 years. So they already have that kind of Chinese orientation. This could increase that trend all the more.
I think we will see it increase, and especially significant is the Philippines, which on December 30th, comparatively late, at least compared to the other nations who have signed up for the AIIB, the leadership there in the Philippines said that they are very much open to joining, which was really significant because the Philippines has been one of the number one nations that is terrified of China's rise and this increasing aggression. But now I think we could see the Philippines be a little more quiet about those artificial islands that China's building right in their backyard. The Philippines may say, you know what, we're gonna just, you know, be a little quiet about this in hopes that China will be a little more liberal with its financing of our infrastructure projects.
Robert, how much does this affect China sort of using its tools to rally Asia together in in one alliance. Like we've talked about just the relationships among these Asian nations coming together, just the way that we have been saying is going to happen based on biblical prophecy for many years. Does this represent also a move forward in that direction?
I think so. Anytime you have an institution that is now going to be making billions of dollars available, you're going to start seeing allegiances change. Right now, many of those nations, like Jeremiah was saying, the Philippines, look to America for a lot of that funding. Well, now there's alternatives in place, and that is going to erode U.S. Influence in that region. The president of the AIB bank, Jin Lukun, he's a Chinese, and he said that the bank under his leadership would focus on bridging divides between the regional economies. So I think we are going to see a focus on that. He talked a lot about interconnectivity between the nations and developing bridges and links. So I think that this is part of that policy push by China.
You are going to write an article about this for thetrumpet.com, is that right?
That's the plan.
Okay. So we can watch for that in the coming days. If you go onto the website, thetrumpet.com, watch for this article about the AIIB. Again, this major international investment bank that China launched this past Saturday, January 16th. Watch for this analysis on thetrumpet.com. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time.
You're welcome.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
A second important event that happened this past January 16th also occurred in Asia. Taiwan elected Tsai Ing-wen of the Democratic Progressive Party in a landslide victory. Tsai had run on a platform of Taiwanese independence from China. Now, this is a significant departure from Taiwan's president for the past 8 years, who's been very submissive to China. What does this mean for Taiwan's future? Jeremiah Jacques is going to discuss this with us. Thanks for sticking around.
Good to be here.
We're going to start by, I'd like you to just talk about President Ma Ying-jeou and the direction that China has been taking under his administration for the past 8 years.
Okay, sure. Yes, he came into power in 2008, and his reign was really characterized by an effort to improve Taiwan's relationship with China, and he accomplished that largely by giving in to Beijing.
Well, maybe we could just back up even further. The relationship between Taiwan and China, obviously very strained for generations.
Yes.
So a reconciliation between these two was actually a very significant development to begin with.
Yeah, it was. Really, for as long as Taiwan has existed as a separate country, the two sides have been really, really, there's just been a great strain between them. The very fact that Taiwan and China exist as separate nations is the result of a very bloody civil war that raged from 1927 right up until 1949 or 1950. And at that time, in 1949, the communists in China defeated the Kuomintang and forced them out of mainland China. And that's when they fled to the island of Taiwan, about 110 miles off the coast of China there. And so ever since then, you know, this was some 60, 70 years ago there. Ever since then, China, under the Communist Party, has actively claimed ownership of Taiwan. They've always viewed it as kind of a renegade state, a breakaway province, and they've often threatened to use force to dominate China. And so for decades and decades, the Taiwanese lived in fear of this kind of invasion from Chinese forces, but they've been able to retain their independence largely thanks to military equipment, political support, and a promise from the United States.
I remember the article, I think, was it 1998, that Gerald Flory wrote about how he expected China to absorb Taiwan because of America's weakening support. And so it's a story that we've been watching for quite some time. And when you had, say, President Ma in there and trying to make this more conciliatory posture toward China, that seemed very much in line with what Gerald Fleury said. Now, Taiwan is taking a different path, or it is certainly appears to be. First of all, why are the Taiwanese so supportive of this pro-independence position?
Well, many Taiwanese were furious about all of President Ma's capitulations to China. A couple of different times we saw mass protests there in Taiwan. I believe 2014, there were hundreds of thousands in the streets just protesting some trade deals that Ma had made with China. These Taiwanese people were worried that these deals gave China too much leverage over Taiwan, economic and political leverage that they were worried that China could use to just control their nation. And so what we saw on January 16th was a landslide victory for Tsai. And she came into power with what's apparently a strong mandate from the Taiwanese people to reverse all of those moves toward being submissive to China that that President Ma had made. So it just seems like they're fearful of China's rise. They don't like this posture that Ma gave to Taiwan, which is one of subservience and submission to China. So they're trying to elect a politician who has promised to take another route.
This is a pretty dramatic situation because you really wonder how China is going to respond. It looked like the country was taking the route that China wanted. China, compared to 8 years ago, is substantially more powerful than it was, and it seems even likelier to really want to take some action against what we see here.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that we've discussed before how right now a nation like China probably believes that it would be a good time to take action like that, even an actual invasion. This would be a prime window for them to do something like that because the security assurances by the United States are the flimsiest they've been in a long, long time. And so from the Chinese viewpoint, they could say, okay, we just saw President Ma leave, essentially, although that actual transition won't happen for a few more months. But we just saw him voted out of office with this landslide victory for a party who has pledged to be pro-independent. And at the same time, we don't think that the United States is really going to back Taiwan if something did happen. So it could be a time when China feels that it's a time to move from de facto control over Taiwan, which it's had for a long time, to maybe trying to assert some sort of official dominance over it.
And you have to wonder, just the additional factor that we've brought up in previous programs, whether the uncertainty of what the next administration in the United States would be would factor into China's calculus as far as how urgent it would be that they take action.
Yeah, it could be that they would feel a little afraid about the fact that a hawkish leader could come into power in the U.S., at which point they would feel like America's security backing of Taiwan would really be substantial, and it would be something that that they would have to face. So, yeah, for that reason, they might view these last 12 months of President Obama's presidency as a really prime time to make some changes.
Well, let's just focus a little bit on that prophecy of Gerald Fleury's. What was it that underpinned his statement that he felt like China was going to swallow Taiwan?
Well, it was in 1998, as you said, and it was just after President Bill Clinton made some statements that were the first time an American president had ever publicly opposed Taiwanese independence. The statements were soft in a way. I don't have the exact quote here, but most analysts said this is, you know, really significant that a U.S. president is publicly making these kind of remarks that do oppose Taiwanese independence. And so,
and it was really a betrayal at that time.
It was, and Mr. Fleury, the editor-in-chief of the Philadelphia Trumpet, came out and wrote a really powerful article just showing how much of a betrayal that was. I'd like to read a quote from that article. Mr. Fleury said, "The Chinese leaders pressured the president and America to speak against our freedom-loving friends in Taiwan. The people of Taiwan fear for their future. They feel betrayed. Once again, America has showcased its broken will to the world. How could anyone fail to see that Taiwan is destined to become a part of mainland China? These 21 million people are going to be forced into the Chinese mold, and it's going to happen for one reason, because of a pitifully weak-willed America.
So it's remarkable to hear that statement and to consider what has happened in the years since then. Here it's 18 years later, and where is China compared to where it was, and where is the United States compared to where it was? You know, it's in a way, you have to just marvel at the audacity, in a sense, of the Taiwanese people and this this new individual that they've elected here, Tsai Ing-wen, to be so audacious, in the face of a real weak America and a very strong and aggressive China.
You really do have to marvel. And the new president has said that she will maintain the status quo. So she's making some appeal to the moderates there in Taiwan. She's taking some realist measures. It seems like she's speaking out of both sides of her mouth in some statements, because she's saying, you know, our party is all about pro-independence. We want to reverse a lot of those moves that President Ma made before me. But then she's also saying, we recognize that we don't want to upset this giant that is China by doing anything to upset the status quo. So it
sounds like a politician. She's tapping into that anger among the Taiwanese people, and yet also being pragmatic about it.
That's exactly right. So it'll be interesting to see whether the new president there ends up towing the line with Beijing, or whether she makes good on those campaign promises to really push for the independence movement.
So just to get back to this article by Gerald Fleury, what I'm wondering is that how strong, say, would the reconciliation between China and Taiwan be? You know, is it something where, if we're looking at this, say, from a biblical prophecy standpoint, how much could there be this kind of the coming to terms, burying the hatchet, but not necessarily a full alliance? There still could be that simmering hostility between the two. So, looking at the statements that he made in that article, how might we expect to see this play out?
Well, I feel like it really could go either of those two ways. We could see the DPP, the new party that just came into power there, we could see them acknowledge that the new reality of a broken-willed America requires Taiwan to continue on that path of submission to China, which Ma had been taking it down. And in that case, I think that the prophecy would still be fulfilled, in a sense, with Taiwan, you know, saying, we kind of are our own country, we kind of aren't, we do whatever China says, though. That would be enough, I believe, to fulfill that Kings of the East alignment between those two powerful countries. But if they take the other path, and if the DPP decides to stay tough against China, then it could prompt Beijing to react with real force and to swallow Taiwan up. And that, of course, would be a much more stark fulfillment of that prophecy. But in either case, though, I believe that we are witnessing the decline of Taiwan's independence, whether that's officially or de facto.
Mm-hmm. Well, with this this event having taken place this past January 16th, we are now ready, thanks to the last of the revisions that you've written on this, to send the revised version of Russia and China in Prophecy to the printer. We're going to have that updated on thetrumpet.com very soon. This booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, is really an informative booklet. It gives a wonderful overview of the significant prophecies regarding Asia and what we can expect to see in Asia's future, prophecies that really we're seeing fulfilled in today's headlines. So we look forward to getting that project off, And you'll be able to read that very soon. So thanks for explaining this to us. Thanks for all the work that you've done on that booklet. We look forward to having that finished and being able to send that out to our readers worldwide.
Pleasure to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
A third major story that occurred this past January 16th is the fact that it was Implementation Day, thanks to the nuclear deal the U.S. made with Iran this past summer. On Saturday, the sanctions against Iran for its nuclear activities were officially lifted. Now Iran has started to tap into the cash that had been frozen. It's successfully transferring some of these billions of dollars worth of frozen overseas assets. I have with me our Middle East analyst, Brent Nachtigall, to talk about this. So, Brent, when this deal was made, there were a lot of investors who were so eager to tap into this Iranian market and begin to do deals. And some of that, I think, already started to happen. Well, what's happening now? What are we seeing now that these sanctions are officially lifted?
Right. We are just seeing an increase of more of the same in that regard. Like you say, before the deal was implemented, you had foreign investors that were having visits to Iran, leaders of European nations having visits to Iran to try and ink some of the pencil, I guess, some of these deals before Implementation Day happened. On the very day that on Saturday, you had Airbus signing a huge contract with Iran. Obviously, that was worked out before the Implementation Day so they could sign that. And we are just seeing an increase, dramatic increase in foreign participation in Iran's economy. We have the Chinese president, Xi Jinping. He's visiting next week with 800 Chinese men, and they're going to be talking about deals and how they can partnership in the future to try and get a windfall out of probably the manufacturing sector inside Iran, but then also the oil that Iran is now going to be putting onto the market as well. So we talked about before this deal was implemented just how the United States President Barack Obama wanted this to happen. He wanted Iran to be opened up to foreign investment, wanted trade to increase because it was thought, or it may be still thought, that would help Iran remove itself from its pariah, from its ways of belligerence in the Middle East.
Right, that it would actually change Iranian behavior.
Right, that it would bring a new order, a new alignment to the Middle East that could benefit everybody, supposedly.
So this is the big concern, right? Let's just talk about the what Iran has done. That, you know, a lot of people that are saying, look, if you flood Iran with $100 billion, $150 billion, it's going to be increasing the activities that got it in trouble in the first place and that made it a pariah to begin with, the terrorist activities and so on. Let's just talk about what's happened since this nuclear deal was struck this past summer that really should give us cause for concern now.
Right. Well, there's plenty of evidence to show that Iran hasn't become a friend of the United States since the July Accord was signed. This is from it's an article in the National Review, and it goes through a couple of these points of what Iran has been up to. It said in October and then again in November, Iran test-fired nuclear-capable ballistic missiles in violation of the UN Security Council resolutions. We've talked about that in the program. This was, you know, if you think that they were worried that they wouldn't get the deal, that they were anxious to get all this money, which they are, or they felt like the Americans might walk away from the table, they wouldn't continue going about these actions pending the implementation day. But they did fire off a couple of ballistic missile tests. And then in November, they threatened to walk away from the agreement unless a UN probe into its allegations of the past weapons research was terminated. That was by the IAEA. They said, well, we know what you've done in the past. We're not going to make you give account for it. We're just going to let that go into the distance. And the UN, with probably pressure from the United States, they agreed to do that. Then in December, Iran fired those unguided rockets near a U.S. aircraft carrier in the Straits of Hormuz. And then it announced to the world that it would be expanding its ballistic missile program that is currently illegal. And then last week, of course, we had the Iranian Revolutionary Guards that took two U.S. vessels and 10 sailors captive, and then paraded those pictures of the sailors' surrender on Iranian television in a propaganda move. All of this has taken place after the deal apparently was said it was going ahead and before they even got the money. But they were not did not feel threatened that the nuclear agreement wouldn't go forward, even after doing all these actions.
Now, Brent, hold on a second here. The those two boats that were captured and then those soldiers, this was a success story for the United States. This shows that diplomacy actually works, doesn't it?
Right. That's the way it was painted in a dramatic PR campaign by the President Obama's administration, that this was a victory. I mean, before, when we weren't talking to Iran, it took weeks to get back the British sailors before, and then maybe this would have ended up in war before or something like that. But what we've seen was this was far from a victory. I mean, they were who came out on top on this? You had the Iranians just flooding the world's media with American soldiers down on their hands and knees, blindfolded, and then hands were up in the air. It looked like America was bowing towards the great Iranian military. I mean, that was a great PR stunt for them. It worked, and we actually apologized. One of the sailors apologized for going into their waters or whatever, and then the administration, I think it was Kerry, Secretary of State Kerry, actually thanked the Iranians for not escalating the situation further when it was they were obviously playing a game with the United States through all this.
A whole lot of warning signs here about the real nature of this regime and the fact that the hope that it would basically give up some of those activities, that it's doing exactly the opposite, that America's capitulation to Iran has created a far bigger problem than it had to start with.
Right. If you want to stop somebody, or if you want to really impose your will on somebody, you've got to stop giving them exactly what they want. And that's what the United States, you know, hasn't done. They have done. They've continuously given the Iranians what they want, regardless of the actions that they've made. This is from Brett Stevens yesterday in the Wall Street Journal. He writes this. He said, "Are these signs of a new and improved regime, just thinking of their actions over the past couple of months, or merely one that is again being given good reason to believe that it can always extract a bribe for its bad behavior?" It's talking about even though they've done all this, they're still getting $100 billion. I mean, there's been no consequence whatsoever. He continues to write, "Any country that believes it will never be made to pay the price for the risks that it takes will take even greater risks." And that's what we're looking forward to into this next year. Some commentators, Tablet Magazine, it said 2016 is going to be a year like no one has ever seen in the modern Middle East, because they haven't had their hands slapped. They haven't had any repercussions from the United States for these actions over the past 6 months, even though they were apparently desperate for a deal.
So the logic here was that once Iran begins to forge stronger ties with the international community, once its trade becomes more robust, that it would put pressure on the mullahs. It would actually make it harder for Iranian rulers to maintain this aggressive posture. Does that work?
That's definitely what was said initially, that if we do get them involved, like you say, into financial agreements with other countries, with Western powers, hopefully the moderates would take control of Iran, especially as those gains filter down into the pretty large middle class in Iran, the more moderate middle class in Iran. Iran, I mean, we can't think about all the 80 million Iranians as crazy jihadists that want to take over the Middle East. That wasn't it pre-1979. They were allies of the United States. They were a Western nation in a certain way. They were not an Islamic regime. But now what are we're hoping that they kind of return back to that. At least that's the hope of the United States administration, of what they've said. But the fruits don't show that. Even yesterday, it was reported in the Times of Israel that 99% of Iran's reformist parliamentary candidates were rejected. They're having an election in February, and it was hoped
that, you know, we've got this implementation of the deal, we're going to have cash coming in, and then the moderates are going to flood the Iranian parliament. Yet, what's the law over there? If you want to run for the government, you've got to be passed by the Guardian Council of Islamic leaders. Nothing has changed. 99% of them were rejected. 30 out of the 3,000 that wanted to run for government are now okay to go forward to be on the ballot. Just 30 out of 3,000. So what chance is there that a reformist, moderate government is going to take hold of the parliament in Iran? They're not even running. There's not enough of them running.
A whole lot of evidence that leaders have to ignore order to maintain this this idea that Iran is moving in the right direction here. So $150 billion flooding into Iran. You know, we're actually going to start to have the opportunity to see what this money is used for.
Right. We've spoken pretty boldly on this program of what we think that they will do with that money and funding their proxy groups all through the Middle East, increasing that pressure on the previously American allies as Iran tries to march over the Middle East, and we're going to see if it happens.
Yeah, what are we going to see in Syria? What are we going to see in Iraq? What are we going to see further afield, even down into Egypt and into Ethiopia, Eritrea, some of these other theaters?
They can buy mercenaries. They can help the Islamic State. You never know what they're going to do with this money. Another way of looking at this as well is looking at the streets of Tehran and seeing what the normal people were doing when this implementation day was announced. And there was a report in the Telegraph today just showing that there was no jubilation. There was no of the middle class or the lower middle class they are now, no happiness on their part. They realized that who's in charge of Iran. And they know while it's an Islamic nation, Islamic-run state, they're not going to see the benefits of this unfrozen cash. They know that the government of Iran has an agenda that doesn't include bolstering their middle class, you know, increasing the, you know, building bridges, that type of thing.
Right. Despite the Obama administration's assurances that that's exactly what that cash
would be
used for.
Right. That's how it was sold. But that doesn't look like that's going to happen.
Well, thanks for that, Brent. You are about a week away from moving to Jerusalem. So
that's right. Heading straight in there to the Middle East.
So we're going to miss you around the office here, but we are going to stay in touch. We're sending some radio equipment with you so that we can continue these conversations, which we thoroughly enjoy. We appreciate all that you contribute to the program here. We'll be reading articles of yours on the trumpet.com and in the magazine. So you've got quite an adventure ahead of you. We're excited for you.
For sure. There's one thing to be on location that really does impact your mind. As you report on these things, it's easy to be a little bit blasé sometimes or casual about the lives that what we're talking about in the people in the Middle East and how it's going to affect the everyday life. But when you're around them, say I'm talking about how we talk about how Israel is threatened by Iran's nuclear bomb. I mean, we're in America right now, and it can seem a little bit far off. But if you're walking down the street in Jerusalem and you see the fear, and you talk to people and you hear about the fear that they have because of this nuclear deal, it does bring a whole new element to the reporting. And I look forward to hopefully bringing more of that perspective when I'm there.
We look forward to that as well. Thanks for coming in. We appreciate your perspective.
No worries. Thank you.
It's time for today's last word.
This past weekend, I took my son to his first gymnastics meet, and it was a terrific event. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was very exciting and enjoyable. I love seeing boys working hard and performing these challenging high-skill tasks. One thing that bothered me, though, was a particular sound I heard at the conclusion of the event, and that was the jangling of metal. For most events, every child received a medal for each one of the six events that they participated in. They got a medal. So they had quite a cache of hardware at the end of this event, not just gold, silver, and bronze for first, second, and third place. They gave medals for fourth place, for fifth place, sixth place, in some cases up to 11th place and beyond. I remember a few years ago, I brought my two daughters to a gymnastics meet where every single participant got a gold medal. Well, it was plastic, but a gold medal for each event and a trophy just for showing up. And at that meet, there were several first-placed winners because they were grouped by age. The 6-year-olds had their first place winner, the 6.5-year-olds, the 7-year-olds, 7.5, 8, 8.5, and so on. I was reminded of a recent high school graduation I attended where there were 14 valedictorians and 17 salutatorians. This is life in America today. We treat our children's self-esteem like it's so fragile that it will perish if it's not put in intensive care on a feeding tube of sugary messages. You're the best. At what point did we decide that it was necessary for every child to leave every sporting event feeling like they had a Michael Phelps scale triumph? Proverbs 26 and verse 28 says, "A flattering mouth works ruin." And maybe there's nowhere where this is more true than with our children. Back in the 1990s, there was an interesting set of experiments conducted 400 10 to 12-year-olds from a variety of backgrounds were given an intelligence test where they had to deduce and predict patterns among sets of various shapes. And when these kids finished, the experimenters told all of them, regardless of their performance, that they had done really well. They got 80% of the puzzles correct. But then there was a twist. 1/3 of these children received no other feedback. Another 1/3 was encouraged with one sentence of praise, essentially saying, "You must have tried really hard to have received such a good score." The final 1/3 of these kids was flattered with one sentence saying, "Wow, to have done so well on that test, you must be really smart." Now that 1/3 group, that's basically what parents and educators tell our kids all the time. Now what do you suppose happened? These same kids were given a choice after that between two further tasks. One task they were told would be tough and they might not succeed, but they would still learn something from it, even if they failed. The other task was easy and they'd probably succeed at it, but they wouldn't learn anything. Now, what's interesting is the children who had been flattered chose the easy task far more than the children who hadn't received that flattery. Tell a kid he's intelligent and suddenly he wants to avoid a challenge and just stick to the easy stuff. The experimenters then gave these same children another set of puzzles. Now, these were far harder than the first, and most of the children did poorly on this test. Interviews afterward revealed that the flattered children, these kids that had only heard a single sentence praising their intellect, they enjoyed the difficult puzzles far less than the other children, and they were much less likely to want to do more of those puzzles in the future. So tell a kid that he's unusually bright, and suddenly he finds a lot less pleasure in taking on a difficult task. Now, all of these children were then told to tell their classmates how they had done on the difficult test. And get this, nearly 40% of the flattered children lied about their grade, almost 4 times as many as the other children. You tell a kid he's smart, and suddenly he becomes far likelier to bluff about his achievements. And finally, these children were given a 1/3 test. It was just as easy as the first. And what happened? Even though all the children had scored about the same the first time, this time the flattered children had a far lower score than their peers. So you tell a kid he's a brain, and then when he fails, he loses his motivation and feels helpless. Now, guess what? The children who had been praised for their effort, not just flattered, but praised for their effort, actually performed the best of all. Where only 45% of the flattered kids chose the difficult task over the easy one, 65% of those who had been told nothing chose that route, but 90% of those who had been given just one sentence of encouragement took the hard route. The encouraged children also found the difficult test more enjoyable, and they were a whole lot likelier to want to do more challenges like that. And when they were given a test comparable to the first, they performed significantly better than they had the first time. All of that because of one sentence of the right kind of praise. What a lesson. Wrong praise can devastate a child's motivation. Stay away from praising your child for some supposed innate ability. You're so smart. You're so talented. Those statements are a trap. Proverbs 29 and verse 5 says, "A man that flatters his neighbor or his child spreads a net for his feet." But praising a child for his effort can really encourage him to stretch himself, to work hard, and then when the going gets tough, to keep at it. So when your child participates in something, don't strangle his neck with cheap medals and a slap of plastic trophy in his hand. Don't talk to him like he's a natural-born Olympian. Look for effort. And when you see that, encourage it. And when he brings home a good grade, talk about how it reflects fine work, solid study habits, concentration under pressure. When he scores an athletic success, praise his diligence or his teamwork or his tenacity in the face of a challenge. Make it specific and keep it honest. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. This program is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. You can find us online at thetrumpet.com. That's where you can find the stories that we talk about on this program. And you can also get a free subscription to this monthly news magazine, The Philadelphia Trumpet. We'd like to hear from you. Send us any comments or questions by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Robert Morley, Jeremiah Jacques, and Brent Nachtigall. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with this thought from Dwight D. Eisenhower. If you want total security, go to prison. There you're fed, clothed, given medical care, and so on. The only thing lacking is freedom. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.